From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Canal Torso Mystery. In 1935, I was asked by the editor of a well-known London weekly journal to spend the night on the banks of the Grand Union Canal at Brentford, where the torso of a man had been found a year previously, as the canal was rumored to be haunted. Two legs found in a parcel in a train at Waterloo Station were believed to belong to the torso, but after many months, the crime was still unsolved. Wanting to learn all I could about the case before I held my night's vigil on the canal, I went to the Lost Property Office at Waterloo Station and questioned the man in charge. He said that one day the previous year, a cleaner found the parcel under the seat of a third-class carriage and brought it to the office. It was tied loosely with string. The official on duty opened the parcel, and in it were disclosed two bare human legs. As the two men stared in horror at the legs, the toes of one of them seemed to waggle. The cleaner was so terrified that he bolted and never came near the Lost Property Office again. The legs had been very crudely severed. My informant could tell me little more, so I then made my way out to Brentford. The night I chose for my vigil was fine. The stretch of canal where the torso had been found was near a railway. There had been much rain, and pools had collected on the banks of the canal, making them muddy and slippery. Viewed in the evening light, the canal and its surroundings looked dismal and uninviting, to say the least. I was walking along the path at the side of the railway when I met a man who asked what my business was there. I explained to him that I was a journalist and was quite unaware that I was trespassing. He was very civil, and I chatted with him about the torso mystery for several minutes. He told me that he had heard that the police had their suspicions about a certain man, but they could not get sufficient evidence to arrest him. This I had already heard. My informant went on to say that he had heard that jealousy was thought to have been the motive for the murder, that it was the same old tale of a man making love to a married woman. In such a case, one of the men has not infrequently to go, and in this instance it was not the husband. He pointed out to me the spot where the torso was found. It was marked with a stake. After he had left, I walked onto the towpath where I met a young bargeman. He told me that he had once seen the body of a woman that had been found in the canal not far from where the torso was discovered, and it was a horrible sight. His detailed description of what he had seen was not comforting, faced as I was with the prospect of spending all night by the canal. And to make it worse, he said he did not expect I should meet anyone when it was dark, as few cared to go near that part of the canal in consequence of the murder and the rumor it had acquired of being badly haunted. When he had gone, I paced up and down the towpath for hour after hour, and as he had forecast, I did not meet anyone. With the waning light came the evening shadows, and very queer some of them looked. The branches of the trees that lined one side of the path assumed strange shapes. The gloom of the trees, the dark water of the canal, the utter silence and loneliness affected my spirits, and now and then I felt inclined to abandon my vigil. I forced myself, however, to keep my post, occasionally resting against a tree. For a while I stood on a bridge and peered into the water beneath, wondering if it contained some such awful body as the bargeman had described. I could well imagine such a spot being haunted. I had left the bridge and was drawing near the staked spot when I fancied that I saw a tall white figure on the far side of the canal. In the fitful light, I could not determine its sex. It vanished abruptly. A few minutes later, on turning around, I was startled to see the figure approaching me. I now got the impression that it was a woman in a white or light dress. It vanished suddenly and inexplicably when it was within a few yards of me. I did not see it again. During the remainder of my vigil, I saw nothing definitely ghostly, but I felt at times the near proximity of a supernatural entity. The darkness, silence, and solitude, coupled with the knowledge of the gruesome bodies that had been found in the canal, were sufficient to stir the imagination and generate illusions in people less imaginative and sensitive than myself. I realized this, and yet was convinced that what I had experienced was not wholly fanciful, but that there were ample grounds for the rumors of the canal banks being haunted. I was not sorry when the dawn broke and my long vigil ended. Haunted churches. In 1873, Marianne Cotton was sentenced to death at Durham Assize after being charged with poisoning her fourth husband and four children. She was strongly suspected of poisoning three more husbands and at least 12 more children. The case created a great sensation in Durham. Mary Cotton's appearance, with her rather long face, thick nose, and hard brown eyes, was not prepossessing. Yet there must have been something about her, a sinister magnetism, to attract men. After her execution and burial, there were reports that the local churchyard where some of her victims were buried was haunted by their ghosts. A postman named Barber had a harrowing experience. He was returning home from a party late on the evening of Cotton's execution, and as he was passing the alleged haunted graveyard of the old rectory, the shrouded figure of a dead child glided out of it. Terrified, Barber ran. The ghost pursued him. On reaching the cottage where he lived, Barber locked and bolted the door. He heard a clicking of the garden gate, and the shrouded ghost entered the cottage, passing through the closed door. Scared out of his wits, Barber raced up the staircase. The ghost followed him. He rushed into his bedroom and locked the door. The ghost did not enter the room. He heard it moving in the adjacent room, and he and his wife went and barricaded themselves in the parlor. For a time they heard the ghost walking about, then suddenly there was a terrific crash. Panicked, they tore out of the cottage to the house of one of their friends. A young man in the house, who scoffed at the idea of ghosts, went to the cottage, saw the shrouded figure, and fled. Finally, an old woman who had had experiences with ghosts went to the cottage and persuaded the phantom to depart. For a long time afterwards, people shunned the old churchyard. Another postman was pursued by a church apparition. He was on his round one afternoon with letters in a lonely lane near Garstang in Lancashire, when a tall figure with a death's head, clad in a winding sheet, suddenly emerged from under a tree and confronted him. Dropping his bag of letters, the postman took to his heels. He could hear the figure padding after him till he got to the parish church, when it stopped. He then looked round and saw it into the churchyard with long strides. His plea to be transferred to another district was granted. A grim story is told of the churchyard of Ferne Church in Ross and Cromarty. A farmer, the evening of his wife's burial, went to the house of a girl living close to the church and asked her to marry him. She accepted him, and just before nightfall was sitting on his knee laughing and joking. The girl's mother, seeing them, was greatly shocked and reminded the farmer that his wife, a good and faithful woman, was only just buried and was still almost warm with life. The farmer laughed and said, "She may look warm enough in her coffin, but she was cold enough when she was put there." Hardly had he spoken when his face became convulsed with terror, for standing in the adjoining churchyard of Ferne, peering at him through the window, was the shrouded form of his dead wife. He fled home, took to his bed at once, and died of brain fever within a fortnight. In certain parts of Yorkshire, people have been known to sit at night in the porches of churches to see the phantoms of people destined to die within the year, and there is an alarming instance of this superstition. An old woman of Scarborough sat in the porch of St. Mary's Church one night, just before 12 o'clock. On the stroke of midnight, phantom figures, one after the other, glided into the church. Most of them were the doubles of people she knew. One of the last to enter the church paused to look at her, and she found herself staring at the spirit counterpart of herself. She screamed and fell senseless. She was found in that condition and taken home, dying very shortly afterwards. A daylight ghost makes an appearance at a church in Bedfordshire, An archaeologist with two of his sons was visiting the church one day when his eldest boy, looking up a flight of steps leading to a singing and organ gallery, saw the figure of a woman in a winding sheet standing erect with her hands crossed. There was something so uncanny about the figure, which resembled a long-dead person, that the boy ran out of the church terrified and told his mother what he had seen. The next day the archaeologist asked the sexton's wife if she had ever seen anything supernatural in the church. "No," she told him. "I've only heard noises, but many people have declared that they have seen the singing gallery ghost. According to the description, it resembles a tall dead woman in a shroud, with her hands crossed and tied at the wrists. Sometimes she is at the top of the stairs, and sometimes in a recess of the buttresses outside the church." She knew of nothing to account for the haunting. Hinchley Church is haunted by ghostly footsteps which pace up and down the aisles in the gray hours of morning. The ghost is believed to be that of a monk who met with a tragic end in the church when it was formerly a priory. This church is also widely known for the phenomenon of the Bloody Tomb, which derived its name from gouts of liquid resembling blood, which was frequently found on it. According to traditions, in 1727, Richard Smith, a local young man, was struck and killed by a recruiting sergeant in Duck Puddle for making a joke that the sergeant resented, and ever afterwards drops like blood were periodically found on his tomb. The village people said that this was because the sergeant escaped punishment. The haunting of Battle Abbey near Hastings comes into the news every now and again. In 1931, when much of the abbey was destroyed by fire, the figure of a cowled monk, which has appeared intermittently over the centuries, was clearly seen. The following year, in July of 1932, the monk was seen again by Mr. John Vane Pennell, a great-nephew of the Duchess of Cleveland, a former owner of the abbey, who spent the night there with his sister. They took camp beds into the inner crypt, which was once the monk's mortuary and is said to be the burying place of former abbots. As they made their way down at about 11:30 p.m., Vane Pennell said he thought he smelled incense. A little after midnight, in the pathway of moonlight thrown by one of the arches, I saw the shadow of what I am prepared to swear was a cowled monk. The shadow was there very plainly on the stone floor of the crypt, and not a sound of a footstep. I awoke my sister, and we both heard a man chanting in a clear, solar voice parts of Gloria in Excelsis. From overhead in the monk's dormitory, we could hear the creaking of wooden boards, although the dormitory is floored with asphalt, and heard the shuffle of footsteps. The sound ceased, after which they heard nothing more. In 1928 occurred the haunting of South Mimms Rectory in Hertfordshire. The vicar of the church, the Reverend Alan Hay, then said, "I have not seen the vicarage ghost, but I have felt its presence. I have awakened several times at 3 a.m. and been instantly conscious of its benevolent presence. I have felt its beneficent influences and been so easy in my mind that I have soon dropped off to sleep again." His wife had the same sort of experience, as had several visitors. One of Mr. Hay's parishioners, Miss Long, said that one afternoon when she was in the church, she saw a man praying in the priest's stall in the chancel, and she wondered at his being there in the afternoon. Suddenly the man disappeared through the closed door leading to the vestry. Miss Long then realized what she had seen was no living person, but a ghost. The description she gave of the apparition tallied exactly with that of Mr. Hay's predecessor. A strange case of a haunting in Somerset is told of St. Decumen's Church, Watchet. A schoolmaster was passing the church one night when he met some robbers who asked him where a rich woman who had died recently was buried. At first he refused to say, but when they threatened to kill him, he told them. They took him to the crypt of the church and bid him open the woman's coffin and take 7 rings from her fingers. He had removed 6 rings and was pulling off the 7th when the woman suddenly cried, "Brothers and sisters, arise quickly and help me. No rest had I during my life, and now they will let me have none immediately after my death." As she finished speaking, all the coffins opened, and the dead came out. The robbers took to their heels. The horrified schoolmaster ran up a flight of stairs and hid in the choir, but the ghosts pursued him. He pushed them away from him, and at midnight they returned to their coffins. The schoolmaster ran home and in the morning sent for the clergyman and told him what had happened, afterwards lapsing into a painful illness from which he died. A few years ago, myself and two friends, hearing that a church in Somerset not far from Bridgewater was rumored to be haunted, spent a night's vigil there. My friends had had no previous experience of ghost hunting and were perfectly open-minded regarding the existence of supernatural phenomena. We had not been told anything definite about the haunting. The church occupied a very isolated position, being more than a quarter of a mile from a village or human habitation and close to a spinney. Before commencing our vigil, we searched the church thoroughly to make certain no one was hiding in it, always a first precaution in investigation of this nature. We then made sure the doors were all fastened and that no one could enter from outside the building. We then sat in the dark in different places in the church. A little after 11 o'clock, my friend, who was seated close to the vestry, called out and asked if we other two were moving about. We replied that we certainly were not. He then told us he had heard very distinctly footsteps in the vestry. He counted them, and there were 9. Nothing occurred after that for a very long time. About 1 o'clock, my two friends, tiring of sitting, went for a walk outside the church, leaving me locked in alone. Every now and then I sensed the presence of something moving along the aisles, but saw nothing. After my friends returned and were again seated, we all heard whispering and muttering around us. The church seemed to be full of ghostly entities. This lasted for some considerable time. When the sound ceased, nothing further occurred, and we left the church soon after dawn. I wanted very much to go there again, but my chances of doing so were wrecked by a London paper learning of our ghostly experience. As a consequence of the paper's mention of it, the church was besieged by newspaper reporters from neighboring towns and crowds of curious people. The vicar of the church was so annoyed by this publicity that he would not permit me to hold another vigil in the building. The famous haunting of Holy Trinity Church, Micklegate, York, is said to have its origin in the days of the suppression of monasteries and convents. A party of soldiers came to the convent attached to the church and were confronted by the abbess, who said she would oppose their entry even if it meant her death. They barbarously murdered her, and the convent was destroyed. Ever afterwards, her ghost has haunted the church. A bright light in the form of a woman has been seen to glide across a window on the east side of the building. The figure has been robed and hooded. After some time, the illuminated figure has crossed the window again, carrying in its arms what looked like a child. It is said to appear often on Trinity Sunday. A vivid haunting is claimed of a church in a Midland county. In this well-known case, a traveler was walking along a lonely road leading to town when he was overtaken by a storm. Seeing the church ahead, he ran to it and found, to his relief, the door was unlocked. Opening it, he was greatly surprised to find a service going on. He sat in a pew and had not been there long before a man entered the building and walked up the center aisle. To the traveler's horror, the man was headless. Leaning against a pillar, looking at the clergyman, was a tall, dark man. There was something very sinister about him, and he regarded the parson with an expression of diabolical amusement. When the parson ascended to the pulpit, he saw the dark man, and his face became convulsed with terror. Weird, ghostly music then filled the church. There were loud peals of mocking laughter. The church was illuminated with a lurid, unearthly light. Then suddenly all the figures vanished, and there was total darkness. As soon as a traveler could recover from his terror, he groped his way out of the building. The storm had ceased, and he was able to continue on his journey. Making inquiries as soon as he reached town, he learned that the church had long been abandoned and was well known to be haunted, but that there was no definite explanation for the haunting, nothing beyond the rumor that a rector who lived years ago had practiced black magic. The haunting of Hissington Church, Montgomeryshire, took a very unusual form. A man who had lived a very evil life died at a village not far off, and after his death the country lanes all around became haunted by a phantom bull. One woman who saw it had a fit, another woman fell dead, and many were terrified. One night, after tearing along the lanes, the bull was seen to dash into Hissington Churchyard, where it remained for some time careening among the tombstones. Finally, it went on to the village, where clergymen succeeded in laying it. All church and churchyard hauntings, of course, do not have a feasible explanation, nor do the ghosts that are seen always take recognizable human or even animal forms. They sometimes are neither. One of my own most frightening experiences was at an old cemetery in the Midlands. I was approaching the long-disused cemetery late one night when I saw standing outside it a nude figure about 7 feet high. It had no arms and legs and a round head like that of some bizarre animal. I was badly scared and hurried from the spot. I learned afterwards that an in-law of mine had seen one day a similar apparition squatting on the bed in the spare room of his old house, and that the same thing had been seen outside the village by several people. It was, presumably, a somewhat ubiquitous elemental spirit. Its appearance had no apparent significance. It was merely very terrifying. To go on to legends, St. Bartholomew the Great in Smithfield, London, is said to be haunted by the ghost of its founder, Rayer or Rahir, who lived in the reign of Henry I. The ghost is heard walking along the aisles and ambulatories. I was once alone for a time in this church in the dead of night, but neither saw nor heard anything ghostly. A ghost said to haunt Canterbury Cathedral is that of Joan of Navarre, the second wife of Henry IV, who is buried in the cathedral. Joan was married first to the Duke of Brittany and after his death to Henry IV. In later years, a widow again, she was imprisoned by her stepson Henry V, charged with witchcraft and accused of compassing death of the king in the most horrible manner that could be devised. She was released by Henry V before he died, and spent the last years of her life at the old palace of Havering at Bower in Essex. There she is said to have carried on practicing the black arts, and for her wickedness was doomed to be earthbound. Perhaps the most widely known of all legendary hauntings is that of the chapel of St. Peter ad Vincula and the Tower of London. The story goes that the officer on duty at the tower was one night near the chapel when he saw the windows were illuminated. He spoke to the sentry and asked if he knew the meaning of it. The man replied, "No, sir. I only know there are queer things going on inside." The officer fetched a ladder and, mounting it, peered throughout one of the windows. What he saw nearly made him tumble off the ladder. The interior of the church was aglow with a ghostly light, and walking up the central aisle was a procession of phantom knights and ladies. At the head of them was a ghost the officer recognized from a portrait he had seen. It was Anne Boleyn. After the procession had walked with the slow and measured steps all around the church, it abruptly vanished and the church was plunged into total darkness. Hardly able to believe his senses, the officer returned to his quarters. This phantom procession, headed by Anne Boleyn, who was buried in the chapel, is said to have been seen on other occasions. The Black Monk of Newstead. There are few families in England whose ancestral homes have been more haunted than the Byrons' Newstead Abbey. The ancient home of the clan is steeped in grim traditions, and of all the stories of weird and ghostly happenings that have gathered round this former monastery in Nottinghamshire, those relating to the Black Friar, known as the evil genius of the Byrons, are, in my opinion, the most arresting and extraordinary. Although the Black Friar is said to have been seen during the residence of the Byrons in all parts of the abbey and grounds, he apparently haunted one room in particular, which came to be known as the Haunted Chamber. It is in connection with this room that the following story is told. One evening during the latter part of the lifetime of the predecessor of the poet Byron, a gentleman came to stay at the abbey when it was crowded to excess. This being so, there was no alternative but to give him the Haunted Chamber. Fortunately, he was a skeptic. "Ghosts," he cried, when he was informed that this room was reputed to be haunted. "Ghosts don't worry me, because there are no such things. If I see what you call a ghost tonight, I shall know it is a trickster, and treat him or her accordingly. I am well armed." And he showed his host and those present a pistol, which he assured them was well primed and loaded. He retired to his room somewhat early, for the long journey had tired him, and after he had drunk a final nightcap before blazing fire, he undressed and got into bed. He soon fell asleep, only to wake about midnight with a violent start and the unusual sensation of being chained to the spot, utterly unable to move a hand or foot. The moon was at the full, and in its brilliant beams, pouring with an unearthly whiteness through the window, fell in a broad stream on the panels of a cupboard door, almost directly opposite the foot of the bed. The skeptic, feeling constrained to follow the course of the moonlight, glanced at this door, and as he did so, it seemed to him that the handle suddenly began to turn. Rubbing his eyes to make sure he was awake and not dreaming, he looked again, and as before, he seemed to see the bright, shiny brass handle slowly turning around. Horribly fascinated now, he sat up in bed and stared, and once again he saw the handle in deliberate, very deliberate motion, as if someone at the other side of it was slowly and stealthily turning it. The guest felt under the pillow for his pistol, and then remembered that he had left it in the pocket of his dress coat, which he had thrown across the back of one of the armchairs. He made a terrific mental struggle to get out of the bed to fetch the gun, but his limbs were for the time being paralyzed. They refused to obey him, and he had to remain where he was. Then he looked again at the cupboard door, and at this time he saw it move. The handle had now ceased turning, but the door itself was very slowly and deliberately opening. Of course, he argued, it was a hoax. Some member of the house party, perhaps the host himself, was there in hiding in order to frighten him. What rubbish! He wouldn't be frightened, and yet, as he watched the door, all agleam with cold, white moonbeams, slowly and noiselessly opening wider and wider, a sickly sensation of fear began to steal over him. What was it? Whatever could it be? He kept asking himself, and when would it have done with the nerve-wracking preamble and disclose its identity? A little wider still, until at last he felt, indeed, he was absolutely positive he saw something, but what in heaven's name was it? His heart nearly ceased beating. The thing was so dreadful. It was a white, ghastly white face, with two dark, menacing eyes that gleamed balefully as they fell on him. The door now opened wider still, and a dark figure stepped into the room, and advancing noiselessly towards the bed, disclosed the outline of a monk, wearing a cowl and beads, but with a countenance the very opposite of saintly. Indeed, so horrible was the monk's expression that the guest was petrified and could offer no resistance when the figure came slowly up to him and, bending down, thrust its face right in his. He remained passive until at last the monk, with a loud, malevolent chuckle, turned round and, moving with a curious gliding motion, seemed to amalgamate with the moonbeams and disappear. Nothing further happening, the guest then succeeded in composing himself sufficiently to lie down and try to go to sleep again. However, the morning found him still tossing about in his bed, unrefreshed and heavy-eyed. At breakfast, he narrated what occurred to his host, adding that he firmly believed he had seen a ghost and confessing that he was at the last cured of his skepticism. While he had been talking, Lord Byron, popularly known as Devil Byron, had grown paler and paler until, at the end, he seemed utterly unable to make any response. In a few seconds, however, he pulled himself together, sufficiently to speak, and although still greatly agitated, exclaimed, "What you saw, sir, was the black fire of the Byrons, and since it never appears saving before a great catastrophe affecting some member of my family, you may expect to hear bad news of us shortly." Lord Byron's words were only too true, for within a fortnight, one of his relatives, who is stated to have been in the house at the time the guest underwent his nightmare experience, met with a most tragic death. Another story of the Black Fire belongs to a later period. One evening, shortly before the death of the poet Byron, one of the female retainers of the family arranged a clandestine meeting with her sweetheart, a village swain, in the cloisters of the abbey. Arriving at the trysting place precisely at the appointed hour, she saw someone who, in the uncertain light she took to be her beloved, standing under the shadow of an archway with his back turned towards her. Stealing up to him without making any sound, she was about playfully to slap him on the back for a surprise, when he suddenly turned around, and she saw to her horror that the figure she had thought to be her sweetheart was a monk, who, with ghastly white face and two hollow, lurid eyes, glared devilishly at her. The shock was so great that she fainted. A few days later, the whole country rang with the news of Byron's death. The poet himself firmly believed in this ghost and always declared he saw it shortly before his brief ill-fated union with Anne Milbank. Also, Miss Kitty Parkins, a relative temporarily of the poet's, not only saw the Black Friar but made a sketch of him from memory. There's another story of much later date which I learned when staying in the neighborhood. A farmer was driving home late one spring night in the immediate vicinity of Newstead when his horse shied and then, plunging forward, was off like a rocket. For some seconds the farmer was too intent on trying to curb the animal to notice what was passing around him, but as soon as he succeeded in partially controlling his horse, he became aware of a tall figure clad in black monkish robes striding along the road by his side. In the brilliant moonlight, the farmer could see the figures distinctly, and what struck him as most remarkable was that although his horse was still tearing along at a breakneck speed, the figure by his side was keeping up with it apparently without making any effort at all. At first he thought he must be dreaming, and rubbing his eyes he looked again, but the figure was still there, still striding along in a most leisurely and unconcerned fashion. Presently they arrived at one of the park entrances leading to the abbey, when the figure left them and advanced, still with the same easy mechanical strides, towards the lodge's gate. Impelled by an irresistible curiosity, the farmer turned in his seat to look at it, and then, for the first time, saw it as a whole. Its body resembled that of a very tall man, but the face, which was very distinctly outlined in the moonlight, was that of a skeleton, with two lurid, deep-set eyes. The impression it conveyed to him was one of intense hostility. The farmer, his eyes transfixed with horror, watched the figure pass through the lodge gates, which was closed, and advance up the carriage drive, where it was speedily lost to view. Two or three days later, it was rumored in the neighborhood, the rumor being afterwards verified, that someone closely connected with the Byron family had died very suddenly.